For the Medical Journal of Australia, I'm Kate Swanell. Welcome to the MJA podcast. This podcast is recorded and produced on the lands of the Djabal and Djerriwarr peoples. I would like to acknowledge the traditional owners of this land, their elders past, present and emerging. I'm delighted to have as my special guest today one of the country's most outstanding research leaders. Professor Brendan Crabb, AC, is the director and CEO of the Burnet Institute in Melbourne. The Burnet has been supplying governments with modelling throughout the COVID-19 pandemic, and their latest shows what may happen if mask wearing was reintroduced in a more compelling way. Brendan sat down with me for a wide-ranging chat about COVID, long COVID, reinfection, rebounding, and what we may learn from the COVID pandemic if and when monkeypox hits our shores in earnest. Tell us about the mask modelling. What's the latest?
Look, the latest is that there's a model out from the Burnet that says if masks were introduced pretty much now, remembering that now is probably post-peak, but even if they were introduced now, you could still save 14% or so of the deaths and maybe 20% of the cases by October. So there's very significant gains. Had, of course, they been introduced earlier, much more so. Fact of the matter is, despite a lot of good encouragement to wear masks from the Prime Minister to the Premiers and down, not many people are. It's hard to be precise, but it's probably not much better than 20 to 25% in most places in Melbourne at best. So we're looking at methods to get that up significantly, and masks are one of only really two immediate things you can do. You can get vaccinated and you can wear a mask. There's more than we could do in a sustainable way, but unfortunately, in the middle of a crisis, that's it.
When you say introduce masks, do you mean mandate masks?
Well, find ways to get that number up.
Yes.
We know that mandating does work. You know, there's good evidence to say that it makes a big difference. It's not a trigger you'd want to pull that often, I don't think, and it's certainly not something that needs to be in every circumstance. This particular modelling said if masks were mandated in schools and then there's a sliding window of increase in use in the wider community, then these would be the effects. And so there was a range of effects that came from that. But yes, mandating in a crisis in a place like Australia, which has a pretty poor culture around mask wearing, you know, very different if you're in Singapore or South Korea or Japan, where they're very comfortable with the notion. But here, you know, it's a bit like smoking in a pub, right? Smokers go outside not because they are being nice to you, as a friend of mine wrote recently. Yep. They're going outside because it's mandated.
Yes.
And unfortunately, with masks, we need a similar sort of influence.
Pretty much since the election was called, politicians have been very reluctant to talk about COVID. Do you know why that is? Do you have a theory as to why everybody's gone a little bit cold on talking about this?
Look, it's a very good question. It's clearly been very much the wrong move and the wrong state of mind, because COVID was then, around election time, and is now, one of the top two or three things in Australia. But it's the only one of those top two or three things in Australia that we don't know is the top one or two or three things. So clearly it's been the wrong thing. I think we took a decision back in December when Omicron came along that Omicron was our saviour. I personally took the view that it was a big curveball, a very worrying curveball, something very different to what we'd seen before, almost like a new pandemic with very different characteristics. But our policymakers at a state and a federal level, like many around the world, so they weren't alone, took the view that this actually might be our saviour, that we were well vaccinated. They'd done us a great service. You know, Australia was one of the few countries in the world that got a lot of eligible people double vaccinated before they got infected. This is a gift that governments here had given us. On that very strong base, along came this, in inverted commas, more mild, highly infectious virus. And we took a sort of 1950s chickenpox approach and said, you know, maybe everyone getting infected, we'll see our way out of it. I mean, I was horrified by that, but actually it became, whether spoken or not, the way forward. And I think we've had a lot of trouble getting out of that mindset of, hey, wasn't that our way out of it? Didn't we decide that this was actually going to be okay and one infection and we'd push through was used? Yes, we might have a bit of trouble in January, but we'll push through and then we'll see the end of it. And of course, it's not turned out that way. And I think we've got a lot of difficulty with our governments, especially coming to terms with that, not to mention some of the health leaders who supported it.
Let's talk a little bit about immunity. The words herd immunity and now hybrid immunity are being bashed about a lot, particularly on social media. What's the difference between the two and what are the problems with both of them?
Well, can I say from the outset that the notion that any strategy should involve getting infected fails the pub test, not just the medical test. It fails the pub test. It's plainly a ridiculous notion to get infected to minimize the effects of getting infected. Nevertheless, right from the very beginning in 2020, some countries, the UK and the US in particular, started messing with the notion of herd immunity by infection. Remember, we hadn't even were way away from any vaccines at that stage. You know, as a microbiologist, we don't ever talk about herd immunity by infection. We do by vaccination. But the concept was a really odd one. And very fortunately in Australia, we said, no, we think that's a dangerous idea and we're going to keep our communities from being infected. And of course, once the genie got out of the bottle in the UK and the US and many other countries, it was too late for them. And what's happened has happened as a result, enormous death tolls, long COVID tolls and so on. So that the notion was you push through a single infection, this is herd immunity without vaccination, and you suffer a toll. Take it on the chin was literally the phrase used by Prime Minister of the United Kingdom. And of course, it didn't work out that way. Wave after wave came and devastated the place. Hybrid immunity is a different notion. And really, that's the polite way of effectively describing Australia's strategy. We'll get you vaccinated first, you know, which was a fantastic thing. And then it's basically okay if you get infected because we've got some data from earlier variants to say once you have been infected, of course, very unfortunate if you were, but if once you did get infected, your immunity was pretty good on top of vaccination. So there was this so-called hybrid immunity idea. And so that is the basis. There was some genuine scientific evidence for the notion that people could get infected and build better immunity. It basically was always wrong, but it's not worked worse than was predicted, if that's a fair enough comment. The virus is evolving very fast to avoid prior immunity. That's why we've had the initial strain and then Alpha and then Delta and then Omicron B1, B2, and of course now B4.5 as major variants and other variants in between, and who knows what's next. Whether it's hybrid immunity, immunity to vaccination or immunity to infection, the virus is still getting around it. Secondly, even in vaccinated people, there's a big price to pay as the virus evolves and is getting further away from the strain they got infected by last time or by the vaccine. So people are getting infected multiple times, and every time they are getting infected, the most recent evidence suggests that their risk is cumulative and even potentially worse than cumulative upon subsequent infections, even on the background of being vaccinated. So the notion that infection is our way out is unfortunately was always suspect, but now it's pretty clearly not going to work. And so we're seeing lots of reinfections. It's not that immunity to infection doesn't work. I mean, the whole reason a wave disappears, you know, we're in the BA5 wave now, it's going to disappear. The reason is there's immunity that will build up in people. So it's a real thing. And what's the risk-benefit equation of that? We know that's not going to last long. We know it's going to do an awful lot of damage to get to that point. And there's another virus that comes along next time. And on your second or third infection, you're worse off than you were on your first infection. So it's a strategy that hasn't worked and we need to change. I'm not ridiculing those who did it. I did not agree with it, but there are many people I respect who did agree with it. It's just pretty clear now hybrid immunity is dead and we need to move to can we minimize in a sustainable way people getting infected in the first place as we head toward better and better tools. We don't have good enough tools yet, you know, pharmacological tools like better vaccines and drugs that can do it for us. And you know, that cavalry is on the way. But the notion that people can just keep getting infected and that will somehow boost their immunity, build a magical wall, you know, it's more like a sieve, not a wall that's being built. It's unfortunate. It's a great question you ask about herd immunity, but especially hybrid immunity, because it is the basis of our strategy that is failing.
We've talked a little bit about reinfection there. What about somebody like me who's been careful enough not to get infected at all? As we get further from the vaccine, as it gets less and less efficacious, given that the variants change. If I now get COVID this far down the track, am I going to be worse off than I was if I'd caught it 2 years ago?
Yeah, well, it's a great question. I mean, as a person who I presume is triple or quadruple vaccinated, you would have been better off getting one of the earlier strains. Yes. If you were going to get infected, that is yes. much closer to the Wuhan strain. I said this once to a journalist who's never believed me, but I've said after I was triply vaccinated and Omicron came along, I said I'd rather get infected with Delta than Omicron. Now, Delta is probably a worse virus, right?
Yes.
All things being equal.
Yes.
But I was vaccinated against it, exactly. Yeah. So something, I'm going to make up some numbers now, Kate, but let's just say that against variant X, you were 95% protected by the vaccine. That means you've got 5% of serious illness happen. Let's call that hospitalization. You've got 5% yes. of hospitalization. If against variant Y, you've got 80% protection, that means there's 20% chance of hospitalization. That's a 4 times increased risk. It still yep. sounds like you're very well protected, but actually there's 4 times the chance of you going to hospital with the new infection. And that's the sort of thing that's happening. So now we see lower case numbers than December, January, February, now in Australia in July, but higher hospitalizations and higher deaths, even though we're better vaccinated and even with that hybrid immunity point a bit exposed. The crux of that reason for that is the one I just described. The vaccines are still working. Anybody listening to this, if they only hear one thing, please get vaccinated because they're still working against these new variants, against severe disease. But working is not a binary. It sounds very binary.
But it's not.
They're working less well over time, still fantastically well, but less well. And we're going to need updated vaccines. So, you know, Omicron-based vaccines, of course, which we'll see soon. And then different sorts of vaccines, ones that protect us against all variants, you know, so-called pantropic vaccines. And then even better ones that protect us against transmission, not just against severe illness. Ones that, for example, are nasal sprays are the ones that are being looked at the most that stimulate immunity at the site of infection, not just systemically in your blood. It is fantastic to avoid getting infected.
Yes.
As have I, a mixture of good luck, actually, and good planning,
likewise, to be frank.
There really are only 3 serious things you can do. You know, you can get vaccinated, you can breathe clean air, which means wearing a mask if you're not in a well-ventilated place, and you can get tested. And the benefit of that is if you're positive, you can obviously stop other people getting infected, but you can also get treated. Getting tested is absolutely crucial. You know, we've got some data at the moment, Kate, from mm-hmm. the ABS, the Australian Bureau of Statistics, that is looking at excess deaths. And very worryingly, for the first 4 months of the year, it takes a while to accumulate that data, so we only have it from January to the end of April. The amount of people that died more than you would normally expect based on sort of 5 years prior to the pandemic was more than double the number of COVID deaths. So pretty clearly COVID wow. had driven a big problem itself. Thousands mm-hmm. of people died of COVID, we know that. But more than twice that number died clearly as a response of the pandemic wave of dementia, of cancer, and of heart disease. And so the big question from those people, I mean, firstly, that says the daily surveillance death count that we get is underestimating, which is running at 97 at the moment for Australia, 97 yes. people dying a day. That's probably out by a factor of 2, this data would say. It certainly was in the first 4 months of the year. But the question about those excess deaths that are not COVID diagnosis is, what if they actually did have COVID and we didn't know? Or they had it 28 days before they died? Whatever it is, we really need to understand that. So there's an obvious point. COVID is more lethal even than the daily numbers show. But secondly, we need to understand why they are dying and what we can do to prevent it. My strong suspicion is that testing is crucially important here. How many of those could have been treated with the drugs that are out there if we'd known in time? So that's the first and most important thing to sort out here.
How much of that has to do with this whole thing of dying with COVID, not from COVID?
Look, that's largely a furphy. ABS data that breaks these down, so the Australian Bureau of Statistics takes a while to curate the cause of death. They use doctor certificates and coroner's findings and so on. When they do, they find out that around 85 to 95, depending on the monthly report, of the deaths that are put down as COVID deaths in the daily surveillance were caused by COVID. So COVID was the primary cause of death. For those where COVID was not the primary cause of death, the COVID was not incidental in their death. And so it is largely a furphy, I'm afraid. People aren't just, because there's so much COVID around, just dying because they have the, you know, with this systemic illness that's irrelevant. It was a very convenient argument to use for those who promote lots of infection, but it's simply not true. And people are dying because of COVID. And in fact, those COVID numbers, as I just said, around excess deaths, are underestimating by more than a factor of two the impact of COVID on mortality. Of course, in any one specific case, it's very hard to really know that. That's why you need these data, this hard data from the ABS, to say statistically what's the likelihood. And statistically, the likelihood is that COVID did have an impact. It definitely is having an impact in quite a lot of people, but in any one particular person, you know, some weeks, months after COVID, was COVID the driver of their death or not? It's really hard to know. You need this retrospective figure. But the data is now in, and it is really concerning that COVID is driving a lot of deaths directly, but many indirectly in ways that we don't understand.
Speaking of things we don't understand, long COVID seems to be having a growing list of symptoms with every day that goes past. I think we can probably add shingles to that now, or shingles-like. I know personally, I'm not so scared of the acute COVID now. I'm more scared of what possible long-term effects we have. What's the latest about what is driving long COVID symptoms? Is it an immune response? Is it an inflammation response?
Basically, yes. So it's not quite that simple. But, you know, it's easy to hand wave long COVID away a bit because there are so many symptoms. It's generalized. Oh, gosh, it's heart disease in one person and it's kidney failure in another and it's brain fog in another. But actually, that's what you expect with generalized systemic inflammation and exacerbating what's already underlying in someone or causing primary disease in other circumstances. So it isn't that virus is getting in and infecting every organ in the body and so on, although we are interested in virus getting around. It's shed from the gut, for example, for quite a while. It definitely is a systemic virus, but it's inflammatory responses gone wrong or gone rogue that is driving long COVID. Now, we're not quite sure exactly what the molecular and cellular basis of it is, but it reflects a lot of one of two or three things. The first being the possibility that there is persistent virus. And so you're getting an immune response to persistent virus attacking and attacking and attacking tissues over a long period of time, even though that virus was very low level. Or the virus leaving a mark that causes that tissue to be infected. We call that a superantigen, which is a virus that is able to non-specifically, or viral antigen non-specifically trigger immune responses. Or simply it's just an immune response from an acute infection that never slows down, you know, and just keeps going. What we know is that the virus is very immunomodulatory. Everyone knows that the virus mutates to avoid antibodies to the spike protein, right? I think pretty much the whole world has become an expert in that. But actually, the virus has a lot of other tricks up its sleeve as well. It has tricks to avoid innate immunity. So when you first encounter a virus, specific immunity, what we call adaptive immunity, like antibodies, hasn't kicked in yet. But you have a first line defense called innate immunity. Well, the virus has evolved mechanisms to get around that. Everything you can think of, good pathogens, the reason they're good pathogens, like SARS-CoV-2, as opposed to many other viruses that don't cause you any problem, they can get around and they can evolve to go into battle and to win against your very sophisticated immune responses. And that's partly what's happening here. And then in some people, there really does look like there's overzealous immune response for one of the reasons I mentioned causing chronic damage in various tissues, and that can be in different people. Cardiovascular disease is a particular common one that's very concerning. Brain fog is another. Kidney disease is another. We're seeing increased diabetes. There are these symptoms. They're very real. And I think the most worrying part of it is this evidence of recent times that each time you get infected, there's a cumulative risk. So I'm going to make up a number. If there was a 5% risk of ongoing cardiovascular disease, I think that risk is actually more like 1% or 2% risk, whatever it is, of cardiovascular disease. On your second infection, it's double or more that. On your third infection, it's triple or more that. So there's cumulative damage, or cumulative risk, I should say. We're not clear about whether it's cumulative damage. There quite possibly is, but there's definitely cumulative risk by the looks of the evidence that is out there at the moment. That's extremely worrying. It's the main reason why the hybrid immunity idea, the idea that it's okay to have lots of infection to boost your immunity, has to disappear, because each time you're getting infected, both the acute and the chronic risk is increased. We just can't have that. There is no pushing through to some sort of, you know, utopian point. We all suffer an infection and then we go on and we're okay. I think that was genuinely what was hoped for. It obviously was genuinely what was hoped for. It's not true. You're actually worse off each time you get infected on average. So long COVID, very serious. We're yet to see exactly how it plays out for our labour market, for example. There's a lot of discussion around in the UK, and I'm very pleased to see Minister Mark Butler, our new health minister, take up long COVID so vocally. You know, my advice to government is that the first action against long COVID should be to prevent transmission in the first place. Prevention is better than cure. Already, so many people in Australia are going to suffer from long COVID. The estimates are anywhere between 100 to 500,000. But if we keep going for the next 6 months with another 13 million or so infections, which is what we had in the first 6 months, then that number could double or triple. And so the best way to address long COVID immediately is to switch to a low transmission strategy. But I know, by the sounds of it at least, he's thinking, what else do we do for all these people who are suffering long COVID, who can't work as they once did or can't participate in community as they once did? What, how do we better understand it, and how do we better support those people? And that's really welcome. I know that in the UK, that, you know, the Bank of England's kind of gone into a minor panic, saying, what are we going to do about our forecasts? Because our people are leaving the labour market because they can't work anymore in very large numbers. There's 1 to 2 million people with long COVID in the UK, country of 75 million. I'm like you, because of the brilliance of vaccines, with a little bit of a question mark over new variants getting around them in the future, I'm not so worried about a really severe disease. I am personally concerned for me and my family more about long COVID.
I'm chatting today with Professor Brendan Crabb, who is boss of the WASH at the Burnet Institute in Melbourne. If you're interested in the latest data on COVID-19 in Australia, we've supplied a few links in the show notes to this podcast. Meanwhile, if you're enjoying this podcast, you can catch up with our back catalogue of episodes at mja.com.au/podcasts, where they are free to access. To have our future episodes lob into your inbox each week, you can subscribe to our feed via your favourite podcast platform. Just search for Medical Journal of Australia and click subscribe. Back to our chat with Brendan. And of course, we've got the US president now in his second set of isolation with a rebound from antivirals. What's that about?
It's a good question what rebound is about. As the first point to make is that the two main drugs we have for COVID, Paxlovid and Molnupiravir, are, if you're eligible, incredibly effective. I mean, they're really, really effective. So to an earlier point I made, please get tested if you've got symptoms. Don't wait until you're really sick. And the reason you don't wait until you're really sick is that these drugs only work within the first 5 days or so of infection. If you have them after 5 days, they're much less likely to be effective. So unfortunately, a lot of people get really sick after 5 days. So the big message is get tested. If you're positive and you're eligible, get the drugs. What we're seeing, though, is with either drug, after a course of treatment, so people have the drug, they feel fantastically better, and they become negative on a rat test.
Yep.
And so go back to doing whatever they're doing, as President Biden did, and then the virus is back. Now, we're pretty confident that the virus that's back, it's not a reinfection. It's the same virus that's back some five or 10 days later, right?
Yeah.
After they cleared it. So clearly, the virus wasn't actually cleared. It was reduced to a low level. And this is very interesting in and of itself for rebound, but also as a general phenomenon around COVID-19 or SARS-CoV-2 pathogenesis. Where does it go? Where does it hang out?
Where's its reservoir?
Where's its reservoir? Indeed. And it's not the way we tend to think of acute upper respiratory infections, you know. And how come when the numbers, the drug works so effectively, clearly brought the numbers of virus down to a very small load and you feel well and you test negative, but how come your immune system didn't just mop up the rest? It should have just mopped up the rest, right?
Yes.
And so you got very effective immunity. It didn't happen. So rebound is fascinating in and of itself, and also for what it tells us about viral persistence, the viral persistence that could underpin both long COVID issues and this immunopathogenesis that we talked about earlier, that's driving it, the mechanism that's driving it. Viral persistence, I think, in the next year will be the area of biology that we'll learn the most, if I was crystal balling, and that will explain the most. This could have really good outcomes because, for example, therapies, antiviral therapies might be good to treat long COVID if it turned out the persistent virus was a factor, you know, or that plus a mixture of you know, immunosuppressive agents depending on the circumstance. We don't know the answer to that yet, but understanding it will reveal solutions. So no, rebound is absolutely fascinating. I mean, the other big point to make about the drugs is, when are we going to see resistance to them, and mm-hmm. what else is coming along? I'm sure all the listeners here know that whether it's an antiviral or antibiotic, becoming resistant to it is a certainty. It's a question of time. And we have to have other options up our sleeve to get around that. So that's the other thing we're going to have to look out for. It's mutating very fast and in unpredictable ways. So Omicron followed Delta, but it didn't come from Delta. Delta followed Alpha, but it didn't come from Alpha. And so what else is out there now that is...
In a country with low vaccination rates, just...
Well, that is where those other major variants came from. Yes, they came from countries with low vaccination rates. And, you know, one of the other areas that's real interest to me is how vaccination reduces viral load. Now, we know that vaccination is incredibly effective, as we've talked about, against severe disease. We also know that as we've got these new variants, they're not so crash hot at stopping transmission. It's not nothing, but they're not so crash hot at stopping transmission from one person to the other. But what if I strongly suspect the viral load is much lower, even though it is transmitting. Now, if that is really playing out, then even when there's lots of transmission in a vaccinated population, there's much less chance of new mutants, new variants, because that's a straight numbers game. So yes, Kate, absolutely. The new variants, the radical new variants, have all emerged in low or no vaccinated populations so far. And it's a big reason why we need to vaccinate the world. You know, a third of the world, over 2 billion people, have not received a single dose. You and I have received our fourth, of course. And so there's clearly a moral, ethical side to that. Yes. The circumstance in those countries is vastly worse than the circumstance even in the UK and the US that have had a problem. But it's also very much an own goal. You know, if we don't vaccinate those countries, we have a much worse problem for ourselves, not just for them.
And of course, we've got monkeypox looming on the horizon. What, if anything, can we learn from COVID that will help us with monkeypox?
I would hope we've learned to act in a precautionary way. Act fast, act precautionary. The big mistake with COVID is that we acted, we not just hoped for the best, we planned for the best, you know.
Yes, yes.
But the principle of public health is to hope for the best, but plan for the worst.
Absolutely.
And with a pandemic, that it just can't be more true. You don't know what's going on. Monkeypox, as it's emerging, has some very weird features to it. We should be acting in a precautionary way, not hand-waving it away as a disease of gay men, and we'll see what happens. I mean, this is just frightening to me. It does not mean it's going to turn out to be the worst thing since sliced bread. We just don't know. It's not the way you treat new things that emerge in this way. You act in a strong, precautionary principle way, and you shut it down until you know more. And unfortunately, we're not doing that. And to our point about equity before, you know, it's been circulating in African communities for quite a while. We've known about that and done very little to support those communities until it's important to us. So we're the big lessons from COVID, which we just don't seem to have learned with respect to monkeypox. It is scary, and it is so many problems with it. I mean, first, stigmatizing anything, any particular group that's at high risk is terrible for them and the control of the disease. But it's also just probably not true. And what it means is you take your eye off the ball
for the rest of the
community because you've comfortably boxed it away. So it's just wrong on every front to do anything that remotely doesn't see this as an all of community problem.
So wave a magic wand for me, Brendan. If you were in charge for the day or the week, what would you do right now to mitigate COVID?
Suspect if I was in charge, it would only be for a day or a week because I'd be ousted.
I'd vote for you.
I think the biggest issue for Australia at the moment is a messaging one, and it's a hard message. I would be saying, in as diplomatic and genuinely polite and respectful way as I could, that the strategy that we'd adopted when Omicron arose was the wrong one. We have been more casual with infection than we should have been. And we thought it was going to be okay. It's turned out that you can get infected multiple times, that even infection once is having very substantial collateral damage in our community, not just finding people who are unvaccinated and who are dying at extraordinary rates that are fundamentally shifting our death rates, but of course affecting us in the tens of millions. About 13 million Australians have been infected and they're sick. And so they're not working, they're not picking up the bags, they're not, you know, our hospitals aren't functioning well enough, our schools aren't functioning well enough, travel chaos. And then on top of all that, we've learned more about long COVID, about how real it is, even in the face of Omicron, even in the face of vaccination, and how it worsens every time you get infected. And we're sorry to say reinfection is now common. Now, I would be saying this sobering message to capture the country's attention and then saying, but there's some very good news. This is something we can do something about, and it won't be difficult to do it. It's not COVID that's in the rearview mirror, but lockdowns are in the rearview mirror. We don't need the tools we used in 2020 and a bit of 2021. We have fantastic vaccines. We know so much more about how it's transmitted. It's transmitted through the air. We know how to stop that and mitigate that. And we know the value of some other tools, particularly of getting tested and using therapy if you're positive, or staying home to stay away from other people when you're positive. So we're going to encourage you to use those things. We're going to provide them for you for free. Did you know that masks are good, but an N95 mask is better? And so they'll be available at chemists. They'll be available at points of testing. They'll be available in schools. We'll encourage people to get fit tested. You won't need to use a mask all the time, but in high transmission times, we're going to strongly encourage it. And occasionally it is going to be mandated in certain settings. So this is very doable. It allows life to go on, schools to go on, travel to go on, work to go on. And the very good news is that the science is not standing still. We've got great vaccines now. We are getting better ones on the horizon. We've got new therapies both available now and coming as well. So this isn't a way of life forever. Unfortunately, we have to live with the virus forever. This is true, but that doesn't mean we have to live with lots of it. We're going to switch to living with small amounts of virus. We're going to switch to taking it really seriously so that actually we don't have to take it seriously, because lots of COVID has turned out to be the wrong strategy for this country. That's what I'd say. And it would be difficult, full of criticism. I wouldn't be blaming others. Just as a government, this is what's happened, and trying to turn it around, because I don't think Australians know that it is anything like the scale of the problem that it actually is. I really don't think they know that. And until the Prime Minister and the Premiers and Chief Ministers get up and give the sort of talk I've just given, I don't think we will change the minds of Australians.
Do you think they're close to doing that?
I doubt it. I think there's an incremental improvement in messaging, which I really like. And so that's encouraging. But I'm talking about a sort of step change, really break through this infection is okay and helping us type mindset to infection is not okay and we're not going to tolerate mindset. Yeah. I think we're still in a, guys, help us preserve the health system, and you know, so that we don't have to shut down. I don't think it is we're close to the fundamental mindset. I don't think we've dealt with the blind spot of that Omicron is not mild and it's not going away. The blind spot of airborne transmission. It's pretty hard to see on our federal website really any significant mention of airborne transmission or what to do about it. I mean, as extraordinary as that sounds, you know, I work, Kate, on malaria. Malaria literally means bad air, and in a paradoxical twist of fate, used to be thought of as an airborne disease, and until it was discovered that it was transmitted by mosquitoes. And of course, that changed everything. But it's exactly the same with COVID that was thought not to be airborne, and now clearly is. That's the primary mode of transmission. But we're still in the old days thinking you know, you need to sanitize your hands. It's social distance. How many times do you see social distancing? Please social distance. Well, if you're 5 meters away from someone, you're still in a room that is contaminated through the air, you run a very serious risk of COVID. So we've got some major blind spots, but the big one is a strategic one. We've got to become intolerant of lots of virus in our community, and that has to be made an explicitly clear message from the top. Then campaigns like we have for smoking or road safety is become really possible and will make a tremendous difference. You know, you don't need a mandate if you've won over the community. What we're worried about now with mandates is that the community will revolt. And that's probably true. The reason for that is that we've not won them over. The community doesn't know what value there is in it. I actually understand that. We can mandate. Australians love a mandate. You know, a seatbelt or a helmet or a speed limit or a drink driving rule or smokers outside. We love a mandate, but only when we've bought in to the reason for the mandate.
Yeah.
And with COVID, we have not bought into that. And that's why I say the mindset shift is so important.
Thank you, Brendan.
No, my pleasure, Kate.
My thanks to my special guest today. Don't forget that all our podcasts are open access and available at www.mja.com.au/podcasts. Or you can subscribe to our feed at iTunes. My name's Kate Swanell, and we'll see you next time.